Session number 6016, reel 1.
All right, well, we'll start then, Eddie. Yeah. Can you tell me, first of all, why it was that in 1941 you joined the Royal Navy?
Well, it's conscription.
Were you happy or not when you got your...
No, in fact, I was annoyed because I was just learning a trade that was going to be of use to me later on. Radio and TV, servicing. But the only time I had a decent trade to my name, because pre-war days were very, very bad for any sort of work for young people. I was actually working in a grocer's and provision shop, winding the butter up, which of course wasn't particularly good. But this, I thought, would be of a great advantage, especially the fact that I was working with my two brothers at the same time. They were teaching me what I didn't know, and they actually gave me more attention than they would have done to an outsider. So I was annoyed, really, when I was called up for the Navy.
What was the reaction of your family to you being called up?
Well, I think they thought it was inevitable. We were all brothers of military age, and we all thought we were going. But in actual fact, I was the only one that did eventually go. My youngest brother, rather, he's older than I am, but he went some 3 or 4 years later because he was of more use to the company where he worked than I was as a trainee. And I rather think his papers were sort of shelved for the time being.
Had there been any Navy in your family?
No, I had a cousin who did the same as I did, was conscripted and opted for the Navy.
Had your father been in the services?
No, he was unfit for service in the First World War. He was a baker and had to stay home.
So, when you were called up, were you called up actually into the Navy, or did you have any kind of choice?
Well, no, the first off, I was given a medical at a place where all three services were represented. I went to the Navy first, and they told me promptly that they were full up in my department. I went in as a wireless mechanic. They promptly told me that they were full up. And there was a chap taking me around. He said, well, what do you want to try next? I said, well, I don't fancy the Army. How about the Air Force? So I went to the Air Force, and the same story there. No, I'm sorry, we're full up. And then I went to the Army chap. He said, well, can you do anything else? Can you drive? I said, oh, yes. He said, well, we'll let you know. That was the attitude. Sort of. Nobody particularly wanted me because I was not A1 in health. I was B2. They didn't tell me why, and I didn't ask. Because in those days, if you wanted medical treatment, you had to pay for it. These used to come pretty expensive, too. So I don't think anybody particularly wanted me. And I was only 9 stone in weight as well, which didn't help. And when I eventually got my calling up papers, they were for the Royal Naval Barracks at Portsmouth. It started off reasonably well, like, Dear Sir, then half a dozen lines that only government departments can dream up. And finished up with saying, you will therefore, not will you, you will therefore report to Portsmouth Barracks on May the 6th, 1941, at midday.
And when you got to Portsmouth Barracks, what were your first impressions?
Well, complete shambles. There was nobody at Portsmouth Station to meet us. There was one or two people from the north who didn't seem to know quite what to do. They'd been travelling a lot longer than I had, of course. And they said, well, what shall we do? I said, well, there's a pub across the road here. Let's try that for a start. And we went over and had a few drinks, much as we could afford, because bear in mind, we only had a few pence between us in those days. It wasn't as it is nowadays, when you can pull out a pound note and that's it. A pound would have been our week's pocket money at the most, I should think. And we went over there until about... We were supposed to report the barracks at midday. We were still drinking at 8:30. And somebody suggested we make a move, so I went down to the barracks, sort of ambled down. No urgency whatsoever. We were undisciplined at all, of course, at the time. And just sort of wandered in there and said to the chap, "Here, mate, where do we go?" That's what we said, or I said anyway. He said, show us your papers. So we gave him our conscription papers and showed him. He said, well, we've got a report over there. So he went to a barracks, a part of the barracks had been bombed, which didn't help. We just sort of sat around smoking and chatting. Both, all of us up to our neck, absolutely choked that we'd away from home. Most of us hadn't been away from home anyway. And I used to suffer terrible from homesickness, even towards the end of the war. I never liked going back to the Army leave. It used to take about 2 or 3 weeks to get over the initial coming back. And then the petty officer sort of rounded us all up again and said, come over here and get sort of sign in. Let them know we got there, because a lot of people didn't. They sort of went on the run, tore their conscription papers up and threw them in the fire. Made out they didn't receive them. But I was too afraid, to tell you the truth, because there was prison at the end of it if you didn't go. And she had a very good reason. She was a conscientious objector. You had to sort of state your reason. There had to be very good reasons too. But some of them tore their papers up and simply flung them away. And made out they didn't get them. And of course, after that, the police, whatever service they were in, went round after them. Eventually chased them up and caught them.
So when you reported at Portsmouth, did you get into trouble for being late?
No, I think the PO said to us, the petty officer said to us, you should have been here at midday, to which some chap in the back said, why, what happened? That's as far as he went, like, you know. He sort of gave up after that. He just sort of took us along to the joining office where we signed in to say we were there.
So when this chap cheeked him, did he shout at him back, or did he just...
No, I think he'd been used to it by now, probably, because we were all undisciplined. We were not even in the Navy. Now, heavy signed on, different story then. But we were all civilians as far as he was concerned until we signed on to say we were there for hostilities, or HO, as they used to call it, hostilities only.
So, when you signed on at Portsmouth, did they try to make use of the skills that you had?
Well, I said, what are you? You know, that was all they said. I said, well, I was doing radio repairs, right, wireless mechanic, you. And then I was taken, after a day or two, to the signal school to do a trade test, which I failed.
Where was the signal school?
Within the barracks itself, a huge place in Portsmouth Barracks, an old Victorian place. And
when you say signals test, what did it involve?
Well, I had to repair a huge radio, which I'd never seen before, receiver, but half the length of a piano, I should think. And they deliberately put a port on it and gave me a meter, which I've been used to using. A meter,
yes,
which I've been used to using, test gear. And I checked it and found a port in no time. They started talking to me about theory, which of course I didn't know. My job when I was working was to repair a radio and send it out. Never mind why it went wrong. I'd located the port and repaired it, good enough for the customer to have it, and sent it out. The why from Air Force didn't matter.
So you failed on the theoretical side?
Yes. So then I learned that another chap did the same. You know, you get talking to different chaps. He said, well, don't go as a seaman or a stoker. He said, go as a wireman. He has to do a trade test, but it's simple enough. You can do it easy. So when I went back to the chap, he said, well, how did you get on? I showed him my failure note that I've been given. He said, what do you want to try now? I said, I'd like to try as a wireman now. And he said, well, okay then. Well, this entailed going out of the barracks to HMS Burnham, which is in Pompey Dockyard. And they gave me a trade test there. And the old petty officers that were in charge, there were two of them, said, got any cigarettes? I said, well, I have, as a matter of fact. I took out a cigarette and gave him one. I didn't realise that was going to help me to get through this trade test. He said, can you get all the cigarettes okay? I said, well, reasonably so. Because in barracks they had stacks of cigarettes there. That's one of the most commodity that went during the war, of cigarettes. And anyway, so well, he brings a packet in tomorrow. I said, okay. Well, it was only 5 pence in those days, which is about a couple of pence nowadays. And gave me cigarettes. He said, oh, good. He said, I'll help you to get through this then. He gave me a trade test, doing things I'd never done before, making joints with blow lamps like a plumber does. Certainly doesn't come into radio repairs. But anyway, he was helpful there.
How did he help you get through?
Well, he did part of it for me. And my cigarette helped, of course.
Was it common for this to happen?
I don't really know, but he was certainly stuck to me when I gave him cigarettes.
And can you tell me exactly what the job of a wireman involved?
Well, it's another name for an electrician, really. And most of the stuff on a ship is simple, really, because it's only one wire, the ship being the other wire, because they're all made of metal.
So, when you got through this test, what happened to you next?
Well, I went back and told them I had passed, and therefore I was put in as a wireman and got wireman's pay. Otherwise, I'd have gone as a seaman and got seaman's pay.
What was the difference in pay?
Quite a bit. Although it wouldn't sound a lot nowadays, it certainly was in those days. Plus another shilling a day. 5 pence nowadays.
So, what happened to you next?
Well, I was classed as a tradesman then. So anyway, I was told to sort of wait over there, which everybody was. Just sit around and wait and smoke and chat. Then we sort of given a meal, I believe. And then we went round to another chap who sort of kicked us out. He gave us a hammock. He said, I'll have to give these chaps a few coppers to help, he said. So if you want to have a whip round. So I decided against it. I said, no. I said, I don't want to give, chum.
Get to help fiddle. With what?
Pardon?
To help with what?
Give us decent gear. Otherwise get second-hand stuff. It's just a fiddle. He sort of put it straight in his pocket. Well, I'd been around enough to know that's what he was going to do. There was no skin off his nose to give us new stuff, which is what he was given. Then again, we sort of told to wait over there and we got our gear.
Did anybody else refuse to give him money, apart from you?
Not that I know of.
And did you get second-hand gear?
No, I got brand new stuff, the same as everybody else.
So they'd given their money for nothing, really?
Yes. But also, I came from a working-class district. No, that sort of thing was nothing new to me. Sort of fiddles, backhanders, and being talked into things.
So, were there any repercussions with him later for not having given him the money?
No. He knew that he was on a loser as far as that he was in the wrong in asking for money. So he couldn't say too much, because otherwise if he'd been reported, he'd have been in trouble. He was actually a leading seaman, you see.
Did people grumble about this kind of petty corruption?
That's as far as it went, yes, grumbling and sort of moaning amongst themselves. But I believed in more direct action by saying, no, I'm not giving.
Did anybody ever report anybody for it?
Not that I'm aware of. They could have done, I suppose, but nobody ever sort of knew anything about it afterwards that I know.
So what happened to you after this?
We took our gear and was taken into a mess deck, which was been bombed. There it was a shambles. One end of the building had been completely knocked off. This was the beginning of May, and it was quite chilly still. We sort of put our hammocks into a hammock netting, it's called. It's a thing about as big as this room, I imagine. All sort of slats of wood up. Just sort of dump your hammock in there. Then somebody told you to mark your gear before you sort of dismissed. You must mark it with this marker. Stamp your name on everything you got, your bedding and your hammock.
So this would be May 1942, would it?
No, May 41.
And you keep talking about the bombing. Had Portsmouth at this stage been heavily bombed?
They got it a long time before London did, yes. In fact, I had a brother who worked down there on government work. And he was glad to get back into London.
Did you see any rage yourself in Portsmouth?
Once or twice there were some alerts, but we were told to run straight down into the air raid shelter, which occupied the whole space under the parade ground. It had all been honeycombed with these shelters. It's done in such a way that if a bomb dropped here in one section, the blast would be diverted away from anywhere else. It was designed by a school teacher.
The what?
It was designed by a school teacher. And from above, you couldn't see a thing except the entrances to the shelters. It's quite easy to get lost down. In fact, if you got lost in there, you could probably wander around for hours before you got out. and nobody would really miss you at that stage.
At this time, was it possible to have much fun in your leisure time in Portsmouth, or was it grim?
It was still pretty grim. We were allowed to go, what they call, even on in a Portsmouth boat, it's still classed as a ship, HMS Victory. And if you walk out the gate, you're still going ashore, as they call it. We were allowed ashore each night, from about 4:30 in the afternoon until the next morning. More or less, I think, to get rid of us, get us out of the place, because they weren't geared up. It was a matter of thousands of people being called up, and accommodation for hundreds. In other words, the government, one hand, not knowing quite what the other hand was doing. Somebody had been told, I suppose one minister had been told to conscript as many people as he could and bung them on to the next chap who hadn't got accommodation for them. But it still didn't sort of stop there. They were still calling people up with no accommodation for them in Portsmouth itself. In fact, they opened a camp nearby called Stamshaw, which is further up just outside of Portsmouth, near the Cosham, and put as many people as they could in there.
So when you went ashore or went into Portsmouth, how would you personally spend your free time?
Well, straight to the nearest pub, really. That was all we could do. We didn't know a way around. We hadn't got a lot of money to spend either. So it's a pull down money, each putting sixpence in the kitty, perhaps. When it ran out, that was it. Then we come home, or come back.
Were there any cinemas or dances to go to?
There were, yeah, but as I say, it was all pretty raw and away from home. All pretty homesick and choked at being away, I think, most of us.
How old were you in 1941?
20 years and 6 months. Which was about the same age as most people there.
You were saying that we got up to May 1941.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to you next?
Well, then we were split up into classes and sent to Hailing Island, I was.
Which is near
Portsmouth.
Holiday
camp.
That's near Portsmouth, is it?
Yeah, not too far. It's a lorry, anyway. It's only an island by virtue of the fact that it's, as the Isle of Dogs would be, shall we say, a few yards of water separated that from Pompey. We were told him we were going to training in earnest, which we did.
What did that involve?
Well, not a lot, really, because the Navy wasn't very particularly keen on marching and sloping arms and doing arms drawn. Although we did do that, it wasn't a very important part. We were each given a book, and a leading seaman would sit around and have a chat with us and tell us different things from the seamanship manual. But most of the time, we sort of just, nobody was particularly interested.
Were you having instruction in electrical work at this time?
No, that came much later.
So this was just general training, was it?
This was so you could salute anybody if you were on guard at any time. You knew what to do with a rifle if you were on guard. Because there's so much of that goes on in the forces that as long as you can salute correctly, you're okay, like.
So you weren't being trained just with other Y-men?
No, just as a seaman, or at least, I'll stress as a seaman, you see. We didn't have the tradesman gear on, as some trades did.
So how long did this training last for?
Probably about 3 months, I should think. It was during the summer, anyway.
You say there wasn't a great deal of square bashing, but was there any of the kind of rough treatment that sometimes meted out in the army by sergeants and sergeant majors to the...
No, nothing like that. Most of the petty officers are sort of on a good thing. Anything away from sea was a good thing for them. They want to hang on to it. In fact, very often the petty officer knew that we had no money, would invite us out to have a drink with him in the evening.
So you socialised with the NCOs?
Yeah, with the petty officers.
After your 3 months training at Hailing Island, where did you go next?
Back to barracks, which is the usual case. Doesn't matter where you've been, you always went back to depot first. That was your depot. There were three depots, Portsmouth, Devonport, or Plymouth Way, and Chatham. Portsmouth was HMS Victory, Devonport was HMS Drake, and Chatham was HMS Pembroke. They still maintain the same routine there as you would do on a ship. You'd go ashore just the same. You went out of the gate.
So, what was your day timed according to bells and that type of thing?
Whistles, usually. Ashore.
How did that work?
Bosun's whistle. Bosun would come round and in the morning and sound reveille, which is a certain way he would blow his whistle. What he used to do was come round and shake the nearest chap to him by saying, heave-o, heave-o, lash up and stow. The morning's fine, the sun shines, burning your eyes, when in fact it was probably pouring the rain and blowing a gale. But that was his usual way.
That was his sense of humour, was it?
Well, that's the way they used to call you, you know, make sure that he said enough to make sure you were awake. But he sort of got further than the chap nearest to him to sort of shake his hammock. He sort of went along the row and shook everybody's, just the nearest chap to him. So once he was awake, he knew then that he'd done his job.
So after your period at Hailing Island, you went back to the HMS Victory?
Yes, depot, yes.
And what did you do there then?
Just waited.
Were you doing any duties at all?
Or you'd sort of done this. If you were told to go and do this, you would do that. Or, you know, that's the way it went. There was nothing special. You were just waiting.
You mean you were doing odd jobs, were you?
Anything that was you were told to do. If anybody caught you standing around smoking, you'd say, right, you go and join that group over there and with that broom and have a sweep up and tidy up there. And
so
that went on.
Was this work aimless? Was it just aimless?
It did seem pointless at the time, yeah. But I think, really, the people, the authorities there, the people in authority at the barracks, were as fed up with us as we were with them. They just sort of wanted us out of the way. There was too many of us there. In fact, the first week, I started in the Navy on a Tuesday. And on a Friday, the chap came round, the petty officer came round and said, anybody want to leave a long weekend pass to go home? Of course, those of us that could afford it, could have cost me 15 shillings to get home. And I had a few bob in the post office, which is more than most. I just got a few pound in there. There was a post office in the barracks where I'd go and sort of draw the money out. And I said, yeah, I'll have one. So that was May the 9th. And I went home on a Friday on the train. You were given then the first train on Monday back from Waterloo, that was. And on May the 10th, there was the biggest fire blitz on London possible. When I went up to the city to get me train back to Portsmouth, it was a matter of stepping over the firemen's hoses. Everything was a shambles. And I was late getting back. Instead of getting back about midday, which is when I should have done, it's probably about 12:30.
So did you get into trouble for that?
Well, I was asked why I didn't go to the RTO, which I didn't know. That was a railway transport officer at Waterloo to get a chit to say that I was there, but we couldn't catch the train because of the damage done to the railway. But I was as green as grass at that time. I didn't know a thing about that.
And so was anything.
So I heard nothing further from it anyway.
Can you tell me what your impression was of these raids on that weekend in London?
You were pretty choked about it all because, as I say, I was home and we spend most of our time in pubs when we could. I live with my brother and some people in Heathway, that's near Dagenham. We didn't get very much damage round that way. So usually the chap we stayed with used to leave his wife at home, which he preferred. Well, my brother and I joined him. We had a few drinks in the pub. Not a few drinks, if he wasn't too bothered about the Blitz.
Was it frightening?
Oh, yes. Anybody who told you that they were not frightened, either balmy or stone deaf. Because any next moment could have been your last, any time.
Weren't there air raid shelters to go into?
Well, there was, but I don't know whether you were any better off in those than walking about. The only sort of brick-built efforts, nothing much. Would never stand a direct hit any more than anything else would. Those sort of blast shelters, that's all. You usually got a moment or two's notice if there was one coming your way by the whistle, the sound. You just simply dived or shot in somebody's doorway or close your eyes. You sort of just, obviously had a few drinks, and I assure you it didn't matter too much at all.
What did people's morale seem to be like under the bombing?
Oh, I couldn't care less, I don't think, really, most of them, the people that I knew anyway. We were all infuriated by the fact we had to sit there and take it. That's why I think when I was called up, I thought, at least we've got something to fight back with. Don't just sit there and wait for it. Although these chaps that were bombing us were only doing what they were told to do, the same as I was told to do, doing what I was told to do later when I was told to fire a tap charge over the side. Or help to feed the guns that were shooting at somebody.
Coming back to the base at Portsmouth, what were relations like between the recruits? How did they get on with each other?
Oh, pretty well. They had to, really. Because nobody knew anything for certain. You just sort of chatted to people. I'd be talking to a North Country chap, or a Scotsman even, trying to make out what he was trying to say, while he was trying to make out what I was trying to say.
Was there ever any conflict between the recruits?
No, not that I know of, anyway. We were all too choked to worry about that sort of thing.
So how long were you at HMS Victory?
What, the second time?
Yes.
Probably another week.
Where did you go to then?
I went to a place called St Vincent, which is over in Gosport, which is only across the ferry, to do my wireman's training.
What did that involve?
Well, we were taught Ohm's Law and theory, mainly, which didn't take long to pick up. They made everything so easy, unless you're a blithering idiot, you could pick it up quite simply. And then, as long as you knew the theory, in their idea was that you knew the practice. Well, so happened that I did. I knew the practical side of it because I'd done it before, but there's a lot there that didn't. So when they were put to work on a ship, they had to sort of start from scratch and watch what somebody else did, or do what somebody else told them to do, whereas I was able to do it on my own because of the training I had before in the radio and TV trade.
Did anybody fail the course?
No, nobody that I knew.
Did you have an exam?
Well, to an extent, I suppose you called it that, but it was so simple that a child could have done it.
How long did the course last for?
It's again about 3 months, I think.
So what happened at the end of the 3 months?
Same old story, back to depot. And then they were so fed up with the people just wandering aimless about in the depot, they had a camp at Havant, which is just up the road from Portsmouth, near to London. But there was a big camp there made under canvas. And we just sort of laid about there and waited. It was summertime, and laid about there waiting until you were sent for to go onto a ship. I had a quiet number, I was a guard. That was pretty cushy, that was, because you worked at night, but you left the day free, you sort of go ashore, just the same, back to wherever you wanted to go. And so I enjoyed that. It was summertime, as I say, and the cameras wasn't bad at all.
So what was the ship you did get in the end?
HMS Impulsive, which was, I think, laid down during the 30s, a programme they had, a bit of an old banger. Had it been a car, it probably would have been called an old banger. But with its three boilers and galley fire flashed up, it could make about 30 knots, just over. It used to carry four 4.7 guns, two foiled, that was A and B, and two aft, X and Y. But our main arm was four wicked-looking torpedo tubes amidships, which enabled it to take on ships much bigger than herself and be feared by them because of her manoeuvrability. And with this, these four torpedoes that she carried.
When were you posted to this ship?
It'd be about October time, I think.
October 1942?
No, 41. I think you're about a year out I was actually called up in 41. So after about 6 months training, I was fit enough to go to sea.